Hello, this is class number 23, and in it we continued to talk about affirmative defenses and focused on implied assumption of risk, secondary implied assumption of risk. We also talked about the firefighter's rule and then discussed preemption. And all of these things are, again, affirmative because they aren't saying well, I wasn't negligent. They're saying I was negligent, maybe, but something else too. Perhaps I had no duty, perhaps the type of accident you've already is included in your inherent in your profession, or in the sense of preemption, your entire action has been preempted by a federal statute. So last class we started talking about assumption of risk. We talked about express assumption of risk, which is basically a contract. By a contract, you agree to relieve the defendant of any duty towards you. Then we talked about implied assumption of risk, or the some people call it primary implied assumption of risk, which is basically in the sports sports cases. So courts have said by participating in certain sporting events, certain activities, you've implied that you assume the inherent risks in that activity. And the big question is, what are the inherent risks? Both of these types of assumption of risk, that is express and this primary implied, are complete bars to the action, even under contributory negligence, even under comparative negligence. They're both bars to the action. The big question is, what other kinds of assumption of risk might not be barred, might just be factors to be taken into consideration when apportioning damages? Should an implied assumption of risk defense be allowed to survive under comparative negligence? And you generally see it broken down into, it can be broken down into secondary implied reasonable assumption of risk, which people see as relieving the defendant of their duty, just as a release would have, or secondary implied unreasonable assumption of risk, which is just negligence on the part of the plaintiff and something to be compared with the defendant's negligence. So when should it be just negligent behavior to be merged into comparative negligence to determine damages, or when should it be considered as a complete bar to the action? The case we talked about today, this Cotton Hope case, they didn't get into the notion of reasonable versus unreasonable assumption of risk. Their whole point was, if it's assumption of risk, whether reasonable or unreasonable, they didn't talk about that, can it still be a complete bar to an action under comparative negligence? And the court says no. Comparative negligence and if comparative negligence, the whole idea was not to let a negligent defendant to be relieved of responsibility by the negligence of the plaintiff. So assumption of risk, whether it's for whatever reason, has nothing to do with the negligence of the defendant. It's still, the defendant is still negligent, and comparative negligence allows you to just compare the plaintiff and the defendant. A lot of jurisdictions just treat it like South Carolina did. Didn't talk about reasonable or unreasonable. Some other jurisdictions still continue to have assumption of risk under certain circumstances be a bar to activity. The New York statutes, assumption of risk is still valid as a defense, still can be a complete bar if we're talking, definitely if we're talking about sports. Assumption of risk is still valid in New York, especially in sports. And you have to know that New York is just tough. You know, it's tough in torts, still valid, particularly in the sports arena. And the biggest gray area is just determining what are inherent risks of whatever activity it caused the damage. Those in favor of assumption of risk to being a bar claim that, you know, you need to have personal responsibility, be responsible for your actions. Those opposed to it say merger with the negligence of the other party. This winner-take-all mentality is inconsistent with comparative negligence. Just merge it into another kind of negligence so that the claim would still survive, but the damages would be less. So that the Cotton Hope case, again, you can see how they had a comparative negligence statute. It was clearly a modified, no greater than, so that the court said, let it go to the jury and let them decide whether the plaintiff in going down those stairs, even though he knew they were dangerous, was more negligent in the defendant who didn't change the bulb. Then we talked about assumption of risk in an employment setting. Many cases have adopted the assumption of risk defense to bar suits in dangerous occupation when the hazard is that the hazard that's encountered is one that's inherent in the occupation. So the firefighter rule comes from that. The idea was that firefighter, public safety officers, other police, they're on the scene during dangerous activities and they shouldn't be allowed to sue for the danger that they encounter. They're getting paid to encounter this danger. Their assumption of risk, they know it's a dangerous situation, they assume the risk. So that we're only, you know, of course this rule applies only to ordinary negligence. You can't recover from when it's intentional torts or independent tortfeasors. So if a police officer is walking on the beat and a flower pot falls negligently from an overhead balcony, they can sue for that. That's not a danger that's ordinarily encountered. That's just ordinary independent negligence. Firefighters rule in the very strange case that we read here, says that firefighters rule is only around premises, so it can be asserted as a defense by our hapless defendant here who didn't own the property. and it's based on premises liability. It's only for encountering negligent conditions on whatever property you enter. You know, firefighters are there under emergency conditions, and owners of property can't be expected to resolve all hazardous conditions, even during emergencies. So look at your jurisdiction. The book was in error. Well, I haven't updated the book in a while. Zangi, enforced the firefighter's rule in New York. It was reversed by statute a few years later, so firefighters now can sue for encountering dangerous conditions on property. Then the other defense, which would be a complete bar, firefighter's rule would be a complete bar too if it applied. The other defense that would be a complete bar is preemption. That is, the federal or state, but usually federal legislative scheme, has served to override common law tort action. So did the legislation preclude common law tort action? And preemption can come about in two different ways. Express, that is expressed in the language of the statute, or implied by the legislative scheme. And basically all preemption is, the notion is that that a federal or sometimes state legislative scheme can override any state court action. Federalism is preemption is controversial for several things. It's very pro-business, takes away your right to sue, and is counter to federalism, the constitutional notion of states' rights, that states, if they want to set a higher standard than a federal statute or a federal regulation, they should be allowed to. If they want to say you can sue even though it's regulated, they should be allowed to. The idea of federalism, then, is key to understanding the controversy around preemption. When you are trying to determine preemption, and it's usually in areas that are highly regulated, drug, pharmaceutical cases, environmental cases, can federal EPA statute, can a state have a higher standard than an EPA statute? So the question, look to see whether it's expressly preempted or allowed in the statute itself, and then look to see whether, if it is, then follow that. If you can't tell, look to see whether it's implied in the statute, whether allowing a state court suit that would interrupt the statutory scheme. Lots of these cases come up under failure to warn, under drug labeling. Here it was, although the statute didn't mandate cars having side airbags, even though we know that side airbags are safer. So in spite of the statute not mandating it, was it negligence or design defect on the part of Honda not to have installed side airbags because it was well known to be the safer design of cars? And the court said, well, after a lot of dithering around, although the statute was ambiguous, a Secretary of Transportation memorandum talking about the statute made it seem as if there was no intention on the statute to allow state court cases to proceed. The statute itself, instead of being a bare minimum, actually was a maximum. It intended to be, say, what was the most safe. And since they didn't mandate they had to have them, the statute was considered it to be the most safe. And that was the language, does the statute set a safety ceiling or a safety floor? Anyway, so when you see cases of possible preemption, question at, read the statute closely, or is there something if the statute doesn't say, is there something in the statute that impliedly would preempt state cases? Okay, so next class, we're leaving negligence, leaving it behind, and we're moving on to strict liability for certain types of activity concerning land, pets, dangerous activities, and ultra hazardous activities. So ask yourself the question, do all dogs get one free bite? Okay, so next class we'll start with strict liability.